Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. My name is Nick Argyris, and here we are for the conclusion of the self-help trilogy, two-part trilogy.
Dyad.
To help me are two helpful high school English teachers, Ian and Joe.
A dyad of high school English teachers.
A dyad.
As well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Nick, we have looked at all of the self-help books. We have winnowed them.
These are the best ones.
Sifted them. These are the two good ones.
We found them.
We have brought the two good ones. Last week, Ian brought the Brené Brown book, and this week, I, Joseph Harvey Holeshue, have brought a self-help book called 4,000 Weeks. 4,000 Weeks, which I'd never heard of until like 2 weeks ago.
Is this one of those?
Ian's going to hate it immediately.
I'm just like, I am immediately anxious when people...
Is this the sequel to 10,000 Hours?
10,000 Hours, 4,000 Weeks, 5,600 minutes.
It's good pull. Hello, my name is Dr. Ian DeYoung. I have helped myself to as much help as I need. So this week I'm going to sit back, relax, and be... and not be very hoarse.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
What's your policy on buffets? Do you like the self-helping of buffets? Do you like to just get in there and do it yourself? Or would you prefer a traditional restaurant situation? Or maybe you're a fast casual gal and you like to just kind of get her done, you know, in that way.
I feel like I've never been able to eat enough to make buffets feel like a good trade.
So value proposition is not
there
for you.
Yeah, value proposition is not there for me. My brother Sid, on the other hand, puts buffets out of business, right? Like he's an eater.
And now you're putting him on blast. Ian, what is your policy on buffets?
I have strong...
You get down with the old country?
Strong nostalgic connection to buffets.
Pizza Hut buffet?
Pizza buffet. I used to go to a place called Ryan's Steakhouse, which was mostly just a buffet.
Steak buffet?
That is unheard of.
It was kind of like Ponderosa, where you could buy some steak or you could go to the buffet. And as they got, they were a large family, we just always got the buffet. Mm-hmm. But like, I wouldn't seek out a buffet these days. But when I do find myself at a buffet, it feels so exciting. And I always overeat. And that is, it's like a nostalgic thing. It's a nostalgic overeating. I feel like, this is how it feels to be to be miserable about a lack of impulse control. Yeah.
Now let's complain about it.
Litheads, you can't see because it's an audio medium, but I am slapping my stomach the way somebody who
is fully disrobed and he is rubbing grease all over his belly.
It is a greasy belly.
Welcome, Litheads. Do you don't know Lit, a weekly, or as we call it, strongly podcast, where every week we typically pick a theme and Joe and Ian bring two book recommendations and we pick a winner just to upset them. But not this week. We're just doing one book, just focusing in really on how to help the world. But we still do have some rules. I don't want you to spoil anything, Joe, okay? Mm-hmm. And I don't want you to tell your stories.
Well,
and but you
I
have
had a
one.
Rule.
Joseph, tell me what this book is about. And it feels like just off the bat, just from the title alone, we're going to tear it apart. So go for it.
Nick, the average human lifespan is absurdly, insultingly brief. Assuming that you have 80 years to live, that gives you just over 4,000 weeks here on Earth. That's the premise of this book. The logical path that this book brings you down is surprising, counterintuitive, sometimes scary, and ultimately liberating. This is a book about time management, realizing your own limitations, giving up. It's a book with a simple premise that asks a challenging question. Life is short. How are you spending yours?
This reminds me of a really hateful thing I saw. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was last summer, maybe it was the summer before. But it was one of these social media posts that was breaking down how this kind of math about like you only have this many hours, this many months, this many weeks. But then it was like, it was looking specifically at like summer weekends. Because the idea is summer weekends are more free and open. You can do more things.
More daylight.
You can't go skiing, but there's more light. The temperature is, unless you live in a place like Arizona, the temperature is going to be better. for doing like water stuff or climbing mountains or and it was like this is an absolutely limited resource to the extent where it's like you have less than 100 less than 1,000 summer weekends like in your whole life, mm-hmm. and as such don't freaking waste a summer weekend doing something stupid. Make the most of it because this is like some countdowns are the number is so big it doesn't matter. The number of summer weekends you have is so small already. Everyone wasted is kind of a big loss.
Well, and Ian, you talk about that. You talk about this as hateful, Ian, but I had a similar realization
Joe's
at one
an
point.
Existential crisis this week, everybody.
I have brought an
everybody.
Existential crisis
book. Yay! We've counted all the minutes and all the hours. Guess how many times you're going to hug your kids?
Yep, guess what? There's going to be a last time for that. I read an article, this is years ago at this point, but I read an article that basically made the argument of like, hey, if you think about the time that you spend with your parents, right? Yeah. The time that you spend with your parents.
Everybody's heard this.
Something like 85% of it happens before the time you turn 18 years old, right? Like by the time you turn 18 years old, you spend 85% of the time you're going to spend with your parents. And I think one way you can look at that is, oh my God, my parents are going to die. I'm only going to see them a handful of more times.
That's
but
the first
other way to look at it is, oh, I should be really intentional about scheduling times to see my parents, right? Like it should not be happenstance in my life because I do only have, 15% of the time left with them.
Okay. So this is the counter argument.
Yeah, 100%, right? And this book is, in a lot of ways, it's like the anti-self-help book. Like when I think of self-help
I love
books,
it for self-help week, Joe brought an anti-self-help.
An anti-self-help book. Yeah. Well, like, when I think of self-help, I think of like rise and grind. I think of hustle culture. I think of like, these are 10 tips to improve your productivity, or this is what your morning routine should look like if you don't want to be an absolute piece of shit, right? Like
that's the stereotype.
Right. Like that's what I think about.
Yeah.
This book makes, in a lot of ways, the opposite argument of that. It's like, hey, you have 4,000 weeks here on Earth. That is an incredibly finite amount of time. And most of what you think you're going to do, you aren't going to do, right? Like that's not going to happen.
Right.
So abandon the illusion that you're going to do those things, right?
Ooh.
And
be realistic.
Start paying attention to the stuff that actually matters. And some of that is like the stuff that you know matters, like friends and family and all that good stuff. But a lot of it is like, hey, you should be doing more things that are worth doing for the sake of doing them, not because you're working towards some future imagined goal.
Is this like more about like have a rigid calendar and specifically plan out every moment of your day, therefore it will be intentional?
No, it's not that. It's like aggressively not that one.
Okay.
Right?
I'm confused. Okay. You see my confusion?
Yeah, I see it on your face. On your
see
dumb
it right
face.
There?
On your
are you
dumb
looking
hairy
at it?
Face.
How do you maintain like absolute deliberacy, but at the same time
just don't give a F.
Yeah, like not be too caught
there,
up in it.
Okay, one second. You guys are entering this with a false premise. There is not an absolute deliberacy in this. Like he is not saying rigidly structure your time. That is absolutely not the argument here. He's saying your time is valuable, but even if you try to rigidly structure it, most of that is going to be like poorly adhered to or wasted, or like you're going to be working towards some future goal that doesn't actually matter very much, etc. Maybe I could clarify this with a little bit of a game, right?
I think that's best way to clarify information. Yes.
That's historically on this show, absolutely, that's how we do it.
I'm going to give you a topic that comes up in this book. And based on the little bit of knowledge that you have about the premise of this book, I want you to predict what the author might say about this topic.
Oh my God, Joe, I'm so ready for this
fucking
game.
Okay.
Good, do it.
So the first topic is procrastination. We all procrastinate. We're familiar with procrastination.
Yeah.
What does this author say about procrastination?
Ian, you can go first.
You putting it off? I think this author. Yeah, there it is.
That's funny.
I think this author would say, "Yeah, do some procrastination."
Oh yeah, he's pro.
It's got to be pro.
How can you live if you cannot procrastinate?
his take on procrastination is it's inevitable. Like, you are going to procrastinate. And if you think you're not, you're absolutely lying to yourself. In fact, if you look at everything you want to accomplish in your entire life at any given time, you're procrastinating on almost all of it.
Yeah.
Nice.
It's the number one thing you're going to do. If you put them all into buckets.
Exactly. Brilliant. So he says, you're going to procrastinate. You should choose more wisely what you're going to procrastinate on in order to focus on what matters most.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is just basic time management. Okay. I have a billion things going on with my job, which keeps swallowing more and more of my life. Mm-hmm. And it's all managed procrastination. I am saying that due date is 2 days from now, but that due date is 4 days from now. So I'm going to do the thing that's due. I'm going to procrastinate on the one that's due farther away. I
love it. All right. Number two, you both get like a half point for that one. You were both close, right? Number two, settling. How does this author feel about settling?
You can't control the world. This is a tough one. Ian, do you think settling is good or bad? I'm going to say don't settle.
I would say no.
Yeah. I'm going to say anti-settle.
I would also say like settling is not something that this seems kind of zen, like kind of chill out, let go. But I really don't think you'd be fine with that. Maybe it's the phrasing. Maybe you're being sneaky with your phrasing.
Yeah. Joe, are you being a sneaky little bugger?
I'm trying not to be a sneaky sneak. He says, right, and Oliver Berkman is, of course, who I mean by he says the received wisdom articulated in 1,000 magazine articles and inspirational Instagram memes is that it is a crime to settle, but the received wisdom is wrong.
Oh, no.
You should definitely settle, be more precise, you don't have a choice but to settle, right? Like, you will settle in your life, and that should please you, right? You are going to make choices. Like, everybody in this conversation, everybody listening, you have made choices about your life path right now, right? You have made choices, and by virtue of making those choices, you have disregarded other things. That shouldn't stress you out. Those are deliberate decisions, and the point is to cherish those decisions that you have made.
Okay, now we know. Keep going, Joe.
I was wrong.
On managing your attention. On paying attention.
Paying attention.
Mm-hmm. I'm managing your attention.
Managing attention.
Yeah, he's obviously in favor. It's got to be in favor.
I'm not sure what you mean by that, but I'm going to go with Ian on this. He's got to be pro managing attention.
Yeah, he tells a story about a viral moment that happened on the internet where the staff of some magazine put rubber bands around a watermelon until the watermelon exploded.
Yeah, very good videos.
And it took like 3 hours or something like that, just rubber band after rubber band after rubber band until it finally collapsed. And he said he found himself watching that video for like 2.5 hours that day. And nobody of the 3 million people that were watching this live stream, nobody woke up that day thinking, boy, I'm going to watch a watermelon video for 3 hours today. He says your attention, like what you pay attention to, is your life. You're going to get distracted. You should just be very careful about like what you get distracted by. You should be very intentional about what you get distracted by. Too often your attention is commandeered by forces that you don't have like any actual interest in. The internet is a giant machine for persuading you to make all the wrong choices about what to do with your attention and therefore your finite life. Ian, you have a question. Dr. DeYoung.
This is like attention is a non-renewable resource, right? Like, You have only so much, limited by time, but also limited by other demands, like, you know, battery life and the fact that your boss will say, what live stream are you watching right now? Why aren't you teaching the class you're contracted to teach?
Why did you take your shirt off and you're rubbing butter all over your belly?
What I do with butter in the privacy of my own home. Stop that sentence. The idea of non-renewable resources in terms of these sort of intangibles is really, really powerful.
Well, so like I have a couple more examples, but I think you get the point. Like, the first half of this book is basically this author, Oliver Berkman, making this argument where it's like, look, a lot of what you've been sold in the neighborhood of managing your life and the neighborhood of managing your time specifically is not sustainable, it's not in good faith, and it doesn't actually pay attention to the things that matter. The first half of this book is making that argument where it's like, hey, efficiency is a trap. Like, everything is finite. Like, any choice you make disregards 10,000 other choices. That's the argument in the first half of this book. The second half of this book is basically saying, like, okay, with that established, this is what does matter.
Right, right. Because you can't just say, hey, all the stuff you've been told that all the stuff that everyone says matters, that's actually not that important. You can't just stop there because you're not offering a solution.
It's a little like, just give up and enjoy life because life is short. That's the way the first half has felt to me. Is that basically no need to read the book? Is that pretty much how it's summed up?
Okay, that I think is like...
Because if I could avoid reading this book, I think that would be ideal, Joe.
The author won't totally disagree with that.
Right.
Okay, like, great. He would say, like, there's so a tremendous amount in... Yeah, there's a tremendous amount in this world that's outside of your control, is what he said. And when you look at the world and you get really stressed out about, you know, like, politics or global warming, right? Like, he's like, I feel like one way this, like, my argument could be interpreted is like, hey, you can't do anything about those things. So, like,
just give up.
So just give up, right? Like, don't worry about those things. Give up, right? Okay. They don't affect your life. But in a lot of ways, like, that is sort of the argument that he's making.
It's not now, not true.
He does address it directly. Like, he does address this specifically in the afterword where he's like, look,
hey, there's all these people out there. There's a huge flaw in my argument.
Right. Well, we're like, there's all these people out there like that are basically saying, like,
you might be thinking
the pacifist guides to time management.
There's all these people out there that are basically saying, like, look, the world's going to hell in a handbasket. Right? Like, shouldn't I be doing something about that? And he says,
nah.
Here's the good news. You can't do anything about that, right?
Oh my gosh.
He says, but.
Okay, but.
That should not feel limiting. That should not feel restricting. That should feel somewhat freeing. Because once you realize that you individually cannot stop the course of politics in American life, that you individually cannot stop global warming, you get to focus on the small things that you can do to make the world a little bit better, right? He talks about this ecologist that came to this realization, right? Where he said, I realized a long time ago that we're never going to save every endangered species, right? So you know what I do? I build these salmon ladders. Because like, I can do a very small part, like a very concrete thing towards like helping this species get upstream, like towards doing this thing. And he says that moment when you realize like so much of the world is beyond my control, I'm just going to focus on what I can. He's like, that moment seems terrifying. That moment is freeing. There's a saying in AA that he brings up in Alcoholics Anonymous that it's advice that they give 12-steppers in.
I'm always a little cautious when AA is brought up in self-help books. Can I say that out loud? Is that okay to say?
That's fine.
Yeah. Okay, good. Because I'm always a little like, okay, how much... Are you making this about yourself right now?
I don't think he's talking about his personal experiences in AA. Okay. He's just here's this structure that helps a lot of people. He's like, there's a mantra that you use when meeting a personal crisis, right? And when you're going through something like an addiction recovery or an addiction, like you meet a lot of tiny crises. And he says, the biggest question that comes up in a personal crisis is, what do I do next? What do I do next? And he says, the mantra in AA is, you do the next right thing, right? Right? Like the most immediate right thing that you can see to do is what you do next, right? And that's kind of his argument. He says, look, your time on Earth is incredibly limited. You're not going to get to everything that you want to get to. Your time is finite. Your resources are finite. Your only job is to do the next best thing in line with whatever it is that you value, in line with whatever it is that you hope to accomplish in a small way on this Earth.
Man, remember when you... So he's helping fish, and remember how you
kill them all? Well, I was going to say slaughter, but it was more a careless omission, right?
This is a very poetic situation here, Joe. You might want to rethink maybe getting into ladder work. start building ladders.
Right. Atone for all those carp that I slaughtered with my...
I have a question, though.
Like, it could be... This is your version of pants. Mm-hmm. Ian's book. Color purple.
I have a question about this. So, I think that social pressure can be valuable in that... I'm be careful.
Hold on.
I think if humanity left to its own devices, I doubt that humanity left to its own devices will end up in a place of doing the right thing for the collective. Mm-hmm. My sense is that the right thing differs whether you're saying the right thing for me or the right thing for
us,
the people as a whole, which. Some might seem doing the right thing for the group might seem like not the right thing for me. So, I mean, like, how is this? I might be misunderstanding. How is this not selfishness? Mm.
That's a good question, Ian. Joe, have you explained fully the second part of this book yet? Maybe there's more meat on that bone. Are we good?
No, I think I've more or less captured the second part of the book. Like, it's more basically the first part of the book is like, this is why a lot of the ways that you think about time management are flawed. And in the second half of the book, it's like, here are some truths that you can deal with. And it's truths like, I mean, this sounds simple, but it's truths like, you are going to die, right?
Oh boy.
Like the promise of this book, like you are going to die. You are going to die relatively soon.
Oh,
and
no.
Almost certainly nothing that you have done in your entire life is going to have mattered on a bigger scale.
Oh my God.
Right? Back
to that existential crisis.
It is very existential crisis-y, right? And he says, with that truth established, right? Like, here are some ways to think about how you spend time on Earth. And Ian, what you're talking about here is like, how is this selfish and not selfless? A lot of it comes down to like, this is not an argument for hedonism, right? And a lot of what it comes down to is a phrase that he uses, which is like, you do things that are worth doing for their own sake. And he would argue like, when I build that fish ladder, right? Like that is something that's worth doing for its own sake, right? Like that is me getting value, like peace, fulfillment, whatever that value is, out of contributing to some larger cause.
Yeah, that's
right?
Like he's that's not saying, selfish.
No, it's not selfish, right? Right. It's like, yep, I'm building fish ladders. Just to be clear, he's not the one that builds fish ladders, but the point stands.
Does he do anything helpful for humanity? Or
he writes books.
Books. Yep.
Okay.
He writes books. So the experience that I had with this book actually was kind of odd because when I started reading this, I had seen this recommended a couple of times, and it was something that kind of caught my interest because it felt so different from self-help books. And when I started reading this book, it felt a little basic to me. It felt a little obvious to me, to be honest with you. It felt a little bit like, oh, I don't think this guy's going to say anything that I haven't figured out on my own, right?
Yeah.
And then as I kept reading it, I'm like, well, I mean, it is a little obvious, but I like kind of the philosophical like asides that he goes into. I like how he supports his points. I like the synthesis of all these other thinkers, because to be totally clear, Oliver Burke is a journalist. Like he is not coming out and saying, this is an amazing idea that I have. He's coming out and saying, hey, a lot of really smart people have been thinking about what it means to live like a meaningful life for a really long time. This is an amalgamation of what they've said. And he talks about everybody from like everything from like Taoism to like Friedrich Nietzsche to like Brené Brown, right? Okay. Like it's like
a lot of
like,
source quoting is what you're saying here.
It is heavily footnoted. It's one of those great books that it's a short book. It's something like 225 pages, but it actually stops on page like 185,
amazing.
Which is just
our favorite kind of book. Yeah.
It's our favorite kind of book. As I got towards the end of the book, though, I started thinking like, man, this is a book that I think if it hit the right person at the right time of their life could be actually a life-changing book, right? Because while it is stuff, like it is a synthesis of like what very smart people have said, and while it is stuff that's definitely out there in the universe, it's a lot of stuff that's taken me like a long time to figure out. You know,
sure.
You got to figure it out on your own, and it's kind of nice if somebody just tells you. So I started thinking about like giving this book to students as graduation gifts and stuff like that.
maybe a younger person is what you're saying. Somebody's not as confident as you.
Sure.
In their wise years.
Who has not moved into the sage era of their life, which is what I am actively working
on. So it's a secret young adult book.
It's a YA novel. So yeah, and actually, I very seldom read a book that my opinion about it changed so 180 as I read it. When I started, I thought it was like simple, right? By the time I was finished, I thought it's the right book for the right person. And I bet a lot of people are the right person for this book.
Joe, welcome to Tiffany's. Room for one. are you anything you can't, I feel like you kind of told us what you didn't like about this book, or maybe it kind of changed over the course of the book.
Yeah, early on in this book, like when I first started putting together my show notes for this book, I was kind of ready to slam it. I was kind of ready to be like, ooh, oh, this book could have been amazing. Like the thing that you hear about self-help books all the time is, oh, this book should have been a TED Talk, or this book should have been an article, right? You hear that all the time.
I hear it every day.
So like that would be my Tiffany's. Is for a long time, I read this book with like a little bit of a, like a sour
skepticism,
attitude. a lot of skepticism. I read it. My anti-Tiffany's is, of course, that it eventually won me over. Like I'm eventually pretty happy that I read it, and I do think that this book had has a place in my life.
But
now, but
that's a turn, right? And I think that's a risk. Any book that kind of has to convince you of its value. We talk a lot about nonfiction books that say this thing which you didn't know about is actually super important. Mm-hmm. If those books fail. And you end up like, no, that's actually not that important. Like, yeah. I didn't know about this and I didn't need to know about this. The same thing here. Like, this book, if you don't make that turn, you're not just scrapping the book. You might be scrapping the ideas too.
This is why Do Not Finish shouldn't be allowed. You shouldn't be allowed to review a book on Goodreads if you did not finish it. Okay?
Absolutely.
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Yeah, Goodreads. You didn't do it.
You're listening.
How can you review something you didn't complete?
Shut this down.
Get it out of here.
And we should have like optical trackers too to make sure people do finish books.
Really some accountability.
So you can't just lie and say, yeah, I finished it and I still hated it.
And what should we do to the people who...
Well, we should punish them.
We send them to Siberia, baby.
Right. That's why it's there.
That's why God made there. Siberia, for people to be sent to it.
I don't know what else it's
you
for.
Tell me why Siberia's there. Ian, tell the litheads what to do.
Litheads, if you don't want to be sent to Siberia. Litheads, if you don't want to be sent to Siberia, we encourage you to.
Fun to say, though.
Follow Siberia. Us on just TikTok, nowhere else.
Siberia.
We're not really doing anything anywhere else. You can like us and subscribe and rate us on podcast players of your choice. You can hang out at our website. Call www.tweenvogue.com. That's TWEENVOGUE.com, where you can request that we read books. You can suggest themes for books that we read. You can request stickers. You can listen to old episodes. Most importantly, litheads, you should tell bookish friends about our podcast. Maybe you've got someone in your life who's just sobbing uncontrollably and you want them to help themselves instead of you having to help them. Guess what? We have two episodes on that and at least one previous episode. Share these episodes with your friends. Or we'll send the episodes to Siberia. How about that? Congratulations to Fish. Congratulations to Ladders. And congratulations, most importantly, to Fish Ladders.
Joe, is this quote about Fish Ladders at all?
It is not about Fish Ladders. No, it's about accepting the premise of his book and what you get in exchange for it. Yes. He says... entering space and time completely, or even partially, which might be as far as any of us ever get, means admitting defeat. It means letting your illusions die. You have to accept that there will always be too much to do, that you can't avoid tough choices or make the world run at your preferred speed, and that no experience, least of all close relationships with other human beings, can ever be guaranteed in advance to turn out painlessly and well. And from that cosmic viewpoint, from a cosmic viewpoint, when it's all over, it won't have counted for very much anyway. And in exchange for accepting that, you get to actually be here. You get to have some real purchase on life. You get to spend your finite time focused on a few things that matter to you in themselves right now in this moment. Maybe it's worth spelling out that none of this is an argument against long-term endeavors like marriage and parenting, building organizations, or reforming political systems, and certainly not against tackling the climate crisis. These are among the things that matter most. But it's an argument that even those things can only ever matter now, in each moment of the work involved, whether or not they've yet reached what the rest of the world defines as fruition, because now is all you ever get.